TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report, October 2018. Only 12 years left to save ourselves. Even though the October 8, 2018 release of the latest IPCC report was meant to jolt humanity into action, to bring down carbon dioxide emissions within 12 years, to avoid global catastrophe, a stunned silence fell upon most of the world's media. Two scientists who have been on TUC Radio before are imploring us to notice that the IPCC's report is not urgent enough. They are Peter Wadhams, Emeritus Professor of Polar Ocean Physics, Cambridge University, and Professor Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research, University of Manchester. He's currently teaching at Uppsala University, Sweden. My thanks go out to Stuart Scott with the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative and Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! For giving them a voice. Here first is Professor Peter Wadhams, interviewed by Stuart Scott.
So the IPCC, which has been notably underestimating the severity and the speed for the past 30 years, now they seem to be getting with the program. This report is more properly alarming.
Yes, it is alarming, but in a sense it has to be, because the IPCC has tended to be quite complacent in the way that it's handled global warming and soft-pedaled on certain kind of self-reinforcing feedbacks that I worry about and a lot of people worry about, are feedback mechanisms which are liable to eventually lead us to some sort of runaway warming. Mm-hmm. And those are things like the methane feedback, the sea level rise feedback, the albedo feedback. IPCC has tended to soft pedal on those to the extent of actually forgetting some of them or hoping they don't exist by not mentioning them.
Don't pay any attention to that man behind the curtain in the corner of the room.
And if they're uncertain what its magnitude will be, then by not mentioning it, it sort of goes away entirely and you don't have to deal with it. And there's some classic cases there, like the case of methane from the offshore, whether that could expand to be a major threat. It won't, in the IPCC's view, because they don't consider it in the first place. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the new report, you hope that they've mended some of these, but they've mended some of them, but not all. And really, they still have the same mental view that we just need to do more of the same and even more of the same to keep temperatures down to 1.5 rather than 2. So it's still, there's a big stress on CO2 emissions reduction, except that it's so obvious that at 1.5 you have to focus on carbon dioxide removal.
Do they talk about emissions, not just reductions, about withdrawal, about carbon withdrawal in this new report?
They do, yes, but they don't go into the magnitude of the reduction that's going to be needed. I mean, they say, well, we will have to have CO2 removal from the atmosphere. What they ought to be doing is going into how much CO2 removal per year is going to be needed to keep the warming down to 1.5. And that number is very large. It's at least 20 billion tons. I mean, it's about 40 or 50% of what our present emissions are, is the amount we have to just take out of the atmosphere to keep the warming down below 1.5. And that's such a massive commitment, such a kind of a huge industry is going to be needed that will change everybody's life, that it needs to be considered as part of the warning. I mean, the warning's not meant to be just a warning, watch out or else. The mm-hmm. warning should be, look, unless we do this, we've had it, but this is what we have to do. They really still soft pedal on these tipping points, the self-reinforcing feedbacks. And one of them, I'm just reading what they say, is, of course, sea ice, which I know most about. You look for what they say about sea ice, and it's daft. They say that if we can keep global warming to 1.5 degree, then there'll be an ice-free summer only once every 100 years.
What?
Once every 100 years, we'll have an ice-free summer. But of course, we know that from maybe next year, maybe the year after, we're going to have an ice-free summer, and then nothing but ice-free summers. And that's nothing to doing with plus 1.5. It's the situation as it is now. As well as saying ice-free summers once every 100 years at 1.5, they say that if we let the temperature rise to 2 degrees, there'll be an ice-free summer every 10 years. But even that is, again, equally daft, because we know that that's not the case. This is the kind of thinking of the old-fashioned modellers, the ones who are way behind the curve and saying we wouldn't have ice-free conditions until the end of the century. That sort of modelling, one thought they would be embarrassed enough by reality to withdraw that kind of a modelling approach. But here it is back again, pretending that the situation isn't the way it is. And I notice that there isn't a well-known sea ice researcher's name on the author list. So presumably the authors looked up what was the conventional wisdom. They said, oh yeah, the models say it won't disappear until the end of the century. We'll put that down. But it's wrong. So when there's something like that, something as serious as that, that they get completely wrong, then one doesn't feel too confident about the rest.
You mentioned before three of the areas that are overlooked or deleted that could be runaway cycles in themselves. Can you list them again?
First is the emission of methane from the Arctic offshore. And that's always been a bugbear because IPCC has always ignored it. Mm-hmm. And yet that potentially is a very, very serious threat. And they likewise ignore it in this report.
Your conjecture as to why they ignore it is that it can't be modeled, and so they ignore those who do go there, the expeditionary scientists like yes. yourself and Dr. Shakova. So we'll base it on the models, which say the methane is not supposed to be coming out for 50 or 100 years.
That's it, and it is pretty scandalous. Whenever you get some outrageously terrible thing happening, something that has been predicted and then comes about in terms of hurricanes, extreme cold, extreme warm weather, what you often get out of the scientists is say, none of us knew that this was going to happen. What they mean is, I didn't know this was going to happen because I do modelling and I don't look at data. But what they say is none of us knew. They try to pull me, another observational scientist, into that to say, oh, none of us knew. Well, but in fact, lots of people did know and lots of people predicted it and lots of people warned about it. But then there's another one that has attention's already been drawn to it, how fast sea level rise is going to accelerate. Mm-hmm. And what they do in the report is they take account in the past that the most flagrant failure of IPCC was not to mention the retreat of glaciers at all. Mm-hmm. And simply say sea level rise was due to warming of the ocean. And they produce some outrageously low predictions for where sea level rise would go in the next century, which was terrible because it just was a kind of God's gift to policymakers to be complacent and not spend a lot of money on sea defences. They repented of that in their last assessment, and they included some of the feedbacks due to glacier and ice sheet retreat. And in this one, what they're saying for 1.5 is they're taking account of retreat of Greenland and of the West Antarctic ice sheet, but they're not taking account of anything else. So the things they're not accounting for are the East Antarctic ice sheet, which itself is beginning to retreat, or additional mechanisms happening in Greenland related to the fact that you have this new process of meltwater running down to the bedrock and accelerating. Mm-hmm. The flow of outlet glaciers
through the moorland.
Mm-hmm. Yes, through the moorlands, yeah. That's something that they're not taking account of. And it's, again, it's a question of these feedbacks, which really you can call self-reinforcing feedbacks. It's where something new happens because of warming. The new thing that happens makes things go worse and worse and worse.
Yes.
And it's a self-reinforcing feedback, which, well, I've drawn attention to a lot of them, and other people have drawn attention to them. But IPCC seems to not like self-reinforcing feedbacks because they're things that literally blow up in their faces.
Oh,
and
God.
They don't want anything to blow up in their faces. They want things to perhaps gradually accelerate, but not no surprising things to happen. Because otherwise, I think they feel their call to action will not be heeded if it's too urgent a call, which it seems daft to me. But anyway, that's their attitude.
Now, we've covered two of the three. I thought you had mentioned a third feedback loop.
Oh, yes. The other one that they don't mention is changes in the ocean circulation. For instance, the decline in the thermohaline circulation. It's actually having worldwide implications, but in the Atlantic region, it's reduced flow of warm water up to Europe, so that Europe doesn't warm up as fast as it would otherwise do. But also, the reduced flow of warm water means that warm water's pooling in the tropical Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico, warming up faster than ever. And that's producing a rapid increase in the intensity of hurricanes. Mm. So the intensity of hurricanes is increasing, as we know, each year seems to produce a more destructive hurricane. But that's going to keep happening because of the decline in the thermohaline circulation, even though that lets Western Europe a little bit off the hook as far as warming is concerned. That decline is related, again, to the loss of sea ice, because the sea ice isn't being produced in the Greenland Sea area anymore. That's the region where which drives part of this thermohaline circulation. Mm-hmm. So that's a sort of a known fact, and it's been incorporated in people's thinking. But it's not mentioned by IPCC. They don't talk about any changes in global ocean circulation as being important here. So what I think they're saying is, if we can keep warming below 1.5 degrees, then various other things won't happen. And so we don't have to think about them or mention them. Their reason, I don't think they say it explicitly, but they're saying is, if we find a way to keep the warming down, then other phenomena won't happen. And so we don't have to talk about them. So a methane burst, for instance, won't happen because the sea ice won't retreat, but it's already retreated to the point where you're warming up the coastal seas of the Arctic. It's a mentality of basic complacency when you need a mentality of dire panic warning to say, look, we've got to do things really seriously, desperately.
We need a radical departure.
Yes, I mean, we need one for 2 degrees, because that's not going to be easy to reach, or possible probably, but 1.5, you know, that's really requires something absolutely drastic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to get it, according to this report. We can smoothly go and continue our lives.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams, interviewed by Stuart Scott on October 11, 2018. On the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Next is Professor Kevin Anderson, interviewed by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! They spoke on October 9, 2018.
Florida's preparing for the massive storm as a new report from the United Nations Climate Panel warns humanity has only a dozen years to mitigate climate change or face global catastrophe. The IPCC report lays out several possible pathways to limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, including transitions in land use and transportation systems and the adoption of future technologies, including removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. According to the report, global net carbon emissions would need to fall by about 45% from 2010 levels to by 2030 and reach net zero around 2050. Well, for more, we're joined by Kevin Anderson. He is professor of climate change leadership at the Center for Environment and Development Studies at Uppsala University. He's also chair of energy and climate change at Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research at the University of Manchester in Britain. Dr. Anderson, welcome to Back to Democracy Now! I wanted to ask you first about this report as this monster hurricane goes through Latin America and bears down on Florida and Alabama.
The report makes very clear that between 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming and 2 degrees centigrade of warming, we will expect to see more extreme weather conditions, which indeed is why many of the poorer parts of the world asked the scientific community to actually investigate what are the actual differences between impacts at 1.5 and 2 degrees. And of course, 2 degrees was the previous threshold that we were all apparently aiming for. But as has come out from the report, it's very clear that there are a whole suite of impacts that are much worse at 2 degrees centigrade than 1.5, and that these impacts will primarily hit poorer and more climate vulnerable communities around the world. So it's a very important report in terms of understanding the impacts of climate change and making clear that we must aim really for 1.5 rather than 2 degrees.
You write in your response to this landmark UN report that climate change is ultimately the responsibility of a few high emitters. Explain who they are.
Well, just to put some numbers on this, about half of global emissions arise from the activities of just about 10% of the world's population. And about 70% of all global emissions of carbon dioxide come from about 20% of the world's population. And very closely, the emissions relate to the wealth or the income of the citizens. And so my concern here is that when we try to address climate change and reduce our emissions by focusing on all 7.5 billion people, I think it misunderstands where the actual responsibility for the emissions reside, and therefore we're not developing policies that need to be tailored to that particular 20%. So many people listening to your show now in the US or elsewhere in the world will be medium to low emitters. And to them, yes, it's important they make some changes, but there will also be people listening to this show who are very high emitters. And it is those of us that really the policies need to aim at to drive the emissions out of our lifestyles. And we must make sure in doing that, we don't impoverish people who already are struggling with the current economic system.
Who are the highest carbon emitters, Dr. Anderson?
The highest carbon emitters, well, they're going to be the very wealthiest in this world. From a climate point of view, when you hear the Al Gores and the DiCaprios talking about climate change, and you look at their carbon footprint, they'll be many thousands of times more than an average African, and many hundreds of times more probably even than many Americans. So it is that sort of, the very wealthy are the very high emitters. But also, I think a professor like myself, senior lecturers in universities, the people who are more what we like to see as senior, the language we use, senior in our organizations, whether that's in companies or in the public or indeed the private sector, these people will be the high emitters. I mean, I won't make any comment on journalists, but certainly some of the journalists I'm familiar with, they are also very high emitters. So it is that upper echelons of society.
And in terms of countries?
The biggest emitter now is China, followed by the US. I mean, both of those countries, of course, there's a big difference between the high emitters within that country and the low emitters within that country. So, the two big emitting countries, though, are the US and China, and then obviously shortly followed by the European Union.
If you look at weather reports, whether we're talking about wildfires in California or these monster storms, there is almost no mention by meteorologists, and I'm not talking even Fox, I'm talking MSNBC and CNN, of the connection between these increasingly violent storms and climate change. Is there one, and can you explain it?
Well, there certainly is a connection. What we have done by putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is we've made the atmosphere warmer. In other words, we've put a lot more energy into the atmosphere. That energy will play out in terms of a whole suite of different, more extreme weather conditions. Now, whether this particular hurricane is caused by climate change is impossible to say. But what is often the case is that we are exacerbating or increasing the power in these hurricanes, in these extreme weather events. What we call the fancy language of attribution, where we're trying to say, is this event a climate change event? We're getting better at understanding that. And certainly there's quite a lot of evidence now to suggest that some of the more recent severe weather conditions we've seen have been seriously exacerbated by the additional warming that we've put into the atmosphere from our burning of fossil fuels and the release of carbon dioxide. And the meteorologists should be making that clear link during the weather forecasts within the US.
You talk about what's needed, Professor Anderson. The report says there's no documented historic precedent for the scale of changes required. You have talked about a Marshall Plan. What do you mean, a new Marshall Plan?
Well, the Marshall Plan was the deliberate strategy after the Second World War to try and reconstruct Europe after it had been obviously very severely bombed and destroyed, both institutionally but mostly physically during the war. So I'm saying that that is probably the nearest metaphor or analogy we have to the scale of challenge that we actually face to decarbonize, to shift away from a fossil fuel-based energy system to a zero-carbon energy system, and to do that within the wealthy parts of the world, really within about two decades and probably three or three and a half decades for the slightly poorer parts of the world. So we're not going to do that through small price mechanisms, through just tweaking the markets. It is going to require strategic intervention by governments to make the necessary rates of change. Now, that sounds initially sort of very challenging, and certainly it will be. But I think there is also a positive narrative behind this, in that this transition, this transformation to a zero carbon energy system, will come with lots of job opportunities, long term secure job opportunities, not just in building low carbon power stations, but in the massive electrification program that will be necessary. In retrofitting, in other words, making our existing building infrastructure suitable for the 21st century. So you require much less energy to heat it or to cool it, and that is a much safer environment to be in as the climate continues to change, which it undoubtedly will. Even if we stopped emissions today, we'll see some ongoing climate change.
You have criticized the IPCC for constraining its policy advice to fit neatly within the current economic model. Mm. Can you explain?
Well, certainly. Whilst I think it is a really good report in trying to understand the impacts between 1.5 and 2 degrees centigrade of warming, when it comes to what we have to do about it, I think, again, it runs scared of really being very honest. And given it's effectively a scientific report, I think our role as scientists and as academics is to tell it like it is, not to colour it or sweeten the pill to make it more attractive. So my comments here are that, and it's not just with this report, it's been repeatedly come out of the IPCC. So whilst we're quite direct and honest about the impact side, when it comes to what we have to do about this, we run scared. We don't want to scare the politicians or the public. We don't want to move away from this sort of the energy systems that we have today. So we always try to broadly sort of massage the status quo, so incremental changes, if you like. And what I'm saying is that actually, when you really look at the numbers behind the report, look at the numbers the science comes out with, then we're talking about a complete revolution in our energy system. And that is going to beg very fundamental questions about how we run our economies. And again, you can turn around and say, well, that seems just far too removed from the current economic system we have. But we have to remember it's only been, it's 10 years now since the banking crisis, and many parts of the world are still suffering the repercussions of that banking crisis. So the current economic framework has struggled within its own remit, if you like. So I think this has been a real opportunity, which we are now losing, to reshape that economy so it's an economy that's suitable for society, not a society that's suitable for the economy. And I think the policymakers, sort of the academics, have just run scared of this, of being honest about what our numbers tell us about the rates of change that we require, and how we have to move the productive capacity of our society from building second homes for professors or private jets or private yachts or large four-wheel drive cars, from moving from that to building public transport, electrification, improved homes for everyone. So it's a shift of that productive capacity, the resources and the labour, from the, if you like, the luxury for the 20% to the essential low-carbon infrastructure for all of us.
Dr. Anderson, the effect of Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, the frontrunner Jair Bolsonaro has promised that he will pull out of the Paris Agreement as well and would abolish Brazil's Ministry of Environment, which environmentalists fear would lead to deforestation of the Amazon. Your thoughts on both Bolsonaro and Trump?
Clearly, from a scientific perspective, and I would also argue probably from a moral perspective, they are completely out of tune with what our analysis is saying. I also think we have to be very careful when we see these extreme figures, and both of these, I think, are certainly extreme figures. We have to remember that they are a little bit of noise on the system. The general trend line is more recognition that climate change is a serious issue. Even the poll data in the States shows this. I've not seen data for Brazil, so I'm not sure. But so we are seeing climate change events, and people are thinking this is an important issue. Because some of our, perhaps not always the brightest people who are leading our countries, can't understand that or think that they have a political base they have to appeal to who will not want to hear that message, I think the rest of us should not run scared of them. We just have to redouble our efforts. And indeed, when President Trump decided to pull out of the Paris Agreement, which, of course, he can't do yet anyway, but plans to, then the Chinese and the French stepped forward and said, well, we will try and make some extra effort to compensate. And we also see in the US many mayors saying, actually, climate change is still an important issue. So the US is not a dictatorship. Trump cannot dictate what the population of the US is going to do. Of course, he is important and he is influential, but so are the mayors. So it is incumbent on the rest of us who are more informed by the science, and I would argue with a more reasoned, moral and progressive background to our analysis. And it's up to us to redouble our efforts and make sure that we move in the right direction and not to run scared of the Trumps of this world. There are plenty of them. They will come and they will go. But the overall issue of climate change, the physics of climate change, is here to stay, regardless of the ephemeral whims of the occasional president.
And in this last minute, what does the future look like? How bad can things get if we proceed on this course?
Well, the way things are going at the moment, I think it is quite reasonable to think we are heading to about 4 degrees centigrade of warming across this century. That would be utterly devastating. Just remember, the difference between now and an ice age is about 5 degrees. So we're talking about changes that would normally occur over probably tens of thousands of years, occurring over little more than 100 years. And 100 years, in some respects, sounds like a long time, but many of the people listening to this, their children will still be alive in 100 years, and certainly their grandchildren will be. 100 years is just tomorrow, really, in so many respects. We will be seeing far more famine, drought, floods, changes in food patterns. I think we'll probably start to see lots more tension within communities, and that means then a lot more tension between communities. So as we head towards 4 degrees centigrade of warming, we're talking about breaking down many of the ecosystems of the world. This is a different planet from the one on which we live, and the chaos that will ensue will be bad for our species, for humans, but also, indeed, of course, for many other species around the planet. And that's why we have to do everything we can to hold for 2 degrees centigrade and ideally aim for 1.5. I think that's looking very challenging. So let's do everything we can to keep the temperature as low as possible.
Kevin Anderson, we want to thank you for joining us, the Zennström Professor in Climate Change Leadership at the Center for Environment and Development Studies, Uppsala University, also Chair of Energy and Climate Change at Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research at the University of Manchester in Britain, where he's speaking to us now.
You heard two critical responses by Professor Kevin Anderson and before him, Professor Peter Wadhams, to the release of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Report, IPCC SR 1.5. My thanks go out to Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And to Stuart Scott with the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative for giving them a voice. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.